Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. North Texas is talking about Dallas County District Attorney Susan Hawk's acknowledgement last week that she went to rehab about a year and a half ago to kick using a medication she was prescribed to treat back pain. It happened before Hawk was sworn in as DA, but it serves as a reminder that people can become dependent on drugs that can be legally purchased with a valid prescription. The non-medical use of painkillers, stimulants, and tranquilizers is not a new phenomenon, but it is a real problem that can be overlooked if we limit our understanding of addictive substances to alcohol and street drugs. So how do patients become addicts? How do addicts manage to get more of these medications than responsible physicians would prescribe? And what does it take for patients to gain control over their addictions? We have two guests here to talk about this. Pepper Harper is a case manager at Sante Center for Healing. Dr. Lee Spencer is an addiction psychiatrist on the medical staff at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital and director of chemical dependency at Texas Health Dallas. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you.
The CDC has called the abuse of prescription drugs an epidemic in America, causing 100 deaths a day. What kinds of medications are most often abused?
Well, at Sante, we see a large amount of opiates. It seems that that is an easy one to become addicted. It may be prescribed for legitimate reasons, and tolerance can build up. People can seek more of the drug simply to manage their pain or their stressors, and it can take over fairly quickly. Also, I'm seeing a rise in sleeping medications. Surprisingly enough, a lot of over-the-counter medications eventually become not strong enough, so they seek prescription sleeping medications, and they can become dependent upon it, of course, to sleep. Then they can start using it to cope with difficult emotions.
What does it feel like when you're prescribed an opiate? It will fix your pain if you've got pain, but what are the cognitive and emotional effects of that?
I think one of the reason somebody might start using an opiate inappropriately is because there's a certain subset of the population, for whatever reason, gets a little bit of a euphoria from an opiate. And in fact, people will describe it almost as though it's the thing they've been missing in their life. And it makes them more productive. They find that it gives them a certain energy throughout the day, and maybe they can clean the house better, or maybe they can show up for work more and accomplish more things. So I think that's how it starts out for some people. It may not be that way for everybody, but a certain portion of the population that I find gets a certain euphoria, and that puts them at risk for going on to problematic use in the future.
There are some addictive drugs in which anybody who has been using is clearly altered. And I suppose there are others in which this is not the case. Is it the case that with prescription drugs, somebody can be on this stuff without colleagues or family members or friends necessarily instantly recognizing that something is off?
Absolutely. It really depends on the person, the amount they're taking, their level of tolerance. And many of my patients that I've worked with, they don't use during the day. This is something that they do when they get home in order to unwind. They may use at night and get up in the morning and push through. And so they may come across as depressed or exhausted or anxious, but not necessarily intoxicated. And if they've received a prescription for the drugs, then if somebody does suspect it and they're tested by their employer, testing positive for a medication that you have a prescription for is not a red alarm to that employer, and so they may slip right under it.
Yeah. And keep in mind, these medications are effective and they're good for what they do for their intended use. So opiates are really good at relieving pain. I mean, they very much work. And so, you know, it's a common practice in the United States to take opiates for pain. I mean, I think we consume like 99% of the world's hydrocodone. So it's not uncommon for people to be on hydrocodone because it works. So that might, it's not really, like you were saying, perceived as a red flag when somebody's necessarily using a prescription medication for the intended use. The other ones we've talked about, like the sedative hypnotics and the sedative anxiolytics, what you're talking about, the tranquilizers like benzodiazepines, like Xanax and Valium and medications like that, are really good at relieving anxiety. And that's why a lot of people take them. And so it's, again, it's not perceived as something that's a misuse of a medication just to take it to relieve anxiety because it's very effective. The problem is that it slowly escalates over time. And sometimes people around the person that's misusing the medication might not really see it escalating as a problem. They may see it as this slow, insidious onset of something that becomes very obvious later on down the line when it starts to create consequences and problems in the person's life.
So once a prescription has run out and a patient, for whatever reason, feels like they can't live without this particular medication, what do we know about how they go about obtaining it?
Well, one way that we see them obtain it is by doctor hopping. Going from one urgent care center to an emergency room with various complaints. And they can also obtain them from family members and friends who are no longer using the medications. And there is a underground way to buy them from persons who get the legitimate prescriptions, aren't addicted to them, but use them for secondary income. One way that I commonly see it where I work is through diverting. We treat a lot of medical professionals, and so it's kind of the one for me, two for you type mentality or vice versa, where they'll just simply take a little bit off of the patient's medications, and that can be difficult to track. Mm-hmm. And so they can go a long ways down the road of addiction before they become this becomes alert to their employer or to family members.
Yeah, and they're we don't necessarily have great data on this. We have certain surveys that look at the sort of general population and how they're using prescription medications. But I think among those that are test positive or that checked yes on the survey that they have misused prescription medications, the most common, like at least 60% of them are they first get it from a family member or a friend. So that's usually where it starts out, I think. By the time they get to me, they've probably figured out other ways to get them. I think it's probably the second most common way to get it is doctor shopping. And then pretty soon that wears off. They run out of places to go. We have a new Department of Public Safety has a new website, and so we're able to track that a little more easily than in the past. But that's usually the second way. And then by the time the addiction has progressed or the misuse has progressed, they can find other ways of getting them on the street, buying them on the street, or have a lot of patients that get them off the Internet. And they find sites that they can get them for a little more cheaply than on the street because it's quite expensive on the street. So.
And the Internet sales, I mean, you're supposed to still have a prescription if you buy drugs online. I guess it's easier maybe to falsify that information?
It absolutely is. I mean, basically, on a lot of the websites, you're entering in the data from your prescription and not actually sending in the original prescription. So when that occurs, it's just a matter of putting in enough entries until you get a hit. Something that works. And, you know, there's also a market for it overseas. If you can find the right website that ships it from overseas to the United States and they found a way to get it here through customs, that's another way that they access these medications through the Internet.
Are drug companies profiting from these addictions?
Short answer, probably. That's a difficult question, I guess. I think that certainly drug companies profit from the perceived notions that these are the only medications that will help our patients. So somebody with chronic pain, the idea that the only way their back pain or neck pain or whatever pain is going to get better is with a hydrocodone or a Vicodin or even OxyContin or something like that. That idea is a prevalent one in our culture. I think it's a big cultural norm that we have that the only way to overcome pain or the best and most effective way to overcome pain is by just going and take these opiates because, like we said before, they definitely work. So I think that drug companies have done an excellent job probably of marketing that idea and that culture. And that culture kind of came out of the shift, I think, in the maybe the 90s to 2000s. There was a big shift that really pain – let's just talk about opiates for a second, that pain had to be more effectively treated, that we were largely ignoring pain. And there were all these patients that we were inhumanely treating and ignoring pain. And, in fact, pain became sort of the fifth vital sign on the exam, you know, right next to blood pressure and pulse and heart rate and breathing rate and all that, that if we're not controlling someone's pain, then we're not addressing their needs, their major needs. And so this idea became that we really need to be more aggressively treat their pain. So there was this pendulum shift toward really aggressively treating their pains with opiates. And I think that it probably swung a little too far And that, and I don't know how much drug companies had to do with that as far as marketing or not. I would imagine quite big. But I do think that the pendulum is swinging back the other way.
I wonder, though, there are surveys that say even now as many as 50% of chronic pain patients are under-medicated or under-treated. It's got to be a hard thing for a physician who's seeing a brand-new patient that doesn't have a history with this person to understand, you know, to know if she's making the right decision in prescribing something. Lee, can you talk about some of the things that doctors have to think about, you know, just primary care physicians, in not wanting to feed addiction, but also not wanting to say, you're probably faking it?
Yeah, it's a tough thing because pain is largely very, I mean, it's subjective, right? We don't have a laboratory test or a diagnostic imaging set that can say you're in pain or you're not. And often people have may not have a certain lesion show up on an MRI or on a CAT scan or something like that that can point to exactly what the source of the pain. Oftentimes they do have that, but it doesn't correlate necessarily with how much pain the person is experiencing and what that subjective experience of pain is like for that patient. So the difficult part when you have a patient in front of you that's obviously suffering and obviously in a lot of pain is my first inclination is my job is to relieve this suffering, right? And this is what I'm called to do, and I want to help this person feel better. And so that's always my first reaction. And I'm that's probably shared with other physicians as well, is I want to do whatever I can to help this patient. But then you have to take a step back and think, is this good for the patient? Is this good for their well-being? Is this good for them flourishing down the line? Do they have a propensity to become addicted to something down the road? You know, are there any red flags that I've discovered in my history taking or in any past collateral information that I've gathered from family members or other treating physicians? And so do they have a propensity to sort of abuse things in the past? Is this something I'm worried about? Or, you know, is this are there other ways to treat the pain that wouldn't necessarily be addicting, that wouldn't necessarily even lead to that? Are there non-opiate treatments for pain that haven't been tried in this patient? Has the patient done physical therapy? Have they tried NSAIDs, which are non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, you know, like ibuprofen and naproxen and things like that? Have all of those measures been exhausted, and is there a way that we can try to treat this pain a little more conservatively? So those are some of the things that go through my mind when I'm talking with a patient about their pain and what some of the possibilities might be to kind of help them deal with the pain. Pain may not go away. You know, I tell my patients this a lot, that you probably will always have some degree of pain, whether it's a 7 out of 10 or a 3 out of 10. But let's try to figure out together ways that we can overcome the pain without necessarily putting you on an addictive medication.
I would imagine that's a big hurdle as well, just helping people recognize that they may have to accept living with a certain amount of pain.
It absolutely is. And I think as we work with patients who are addicted to these substances, they are operating under the belief that they should feel nothing. And so convincing them that a little bit of pain is a better alternative to the life that they're currently living, a life addicted, does take some time. But I find as you establish that relationship and you work with them in giving them tools that they can use that are drug-free or something over-the-counter such as ibuprofen, but we work a lot with mindfulness, DBT, neurobiofeedback, some things that they can do within themselves, and they begin to feel empowered. And they begin to feel they can control their pain to a certain level within themselves. And that's when you really see a shift. The buy-in often doesn't come until they learn the tool. So sometimes I have to say, I hear you. Can you just go to this course anyway? Can we just do this? Appease me. And then as they start to go through the process, they start to say, oh, wow, this kind of works. This feels good. And I don't have to hide this.
We're speaking this hour about addiction to prescription painkillers with Pepper Harper, who is a counselor at Sante Center for Healing, and Dr. Lee Spencer, an addiction psychiatrist on the medical staff at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital. We'll resume the conversation in 2 minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about addiction to prescription medications with Dr. Lee Spencer, who is director of chemical dependency at Texas Health Dallas and an addiction psychiatrist on the medical staff at Texas Health Presbyterian. Pepper Harper is here as well. She's a counselor at the Sante Center for Healing. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. How does accidental overdose happen with pills?
Well, one common way that I see it happen is somebody reaches a period of sobriety, whether intentional or unintentional. Perhaps they run out of the medication or drug that they're using, or perhaps they attempt to get sober. And then when they begin to use again, they don't realize that their tolerance has changed and it is returning to a more normal state. And so they'll use the amount of the prescription drug that they had used in the height of their addiction. And while they may have been able to sustain it at that point, it is now fatal to them because their tolerance has changed. Unfortunately, that's the most common way that I see overdoses occur.
Yeah. I mean, that's a difficult thing that patients don't often realize is that their tolerance to a medication, let's take opiates again, tolerance to opiates over time may increase in that their need for that medication goes, that their need to just relieve their current distress for that medication goes up and up over time. So it may not be that they're just getting a euphoria or feeling great when they take Vicodin anymore. It may just be that they have to take 50 milligrams of Vicodin just to make it through the day, just to wake up in the morning and get out of bed, because the body's becomes physically dependent and tolerant to the medication, and it creeps up very quickly over time. I have some patients that take 200 to 300 milligrams of oxycodone or OxyContin on a daily basis, and they certainly didn't start out like they started out with, 5, 10 milligrams. So this tolerance increases over time, slowly at first, and then it sort of really quickly escalates after that. And the problem with that is that the body's tolerance to the medication increases, but the respiratory system, which is sort of, we have these internal respiratory drives deep in our brain and in our respiratory system that can get suppressed by these medications. So opiates can, in their nature, suppress the respiratory drive if they get to a high enough dose. So it's one part of the problems is people gain this tolerance physiologically and psychologically to the medicine, but their respiratory system might not. And so by the time they get to 300, 400 milligrams, someday there might be the right combination of events that could lead them to overdose. The deal with opiates is that, they're probably the most common thing that's overdosed on in the community. The overdose deaths had certainly increased in the early 2000s. The problem with opiate overdose is that often people that are taking just opiates don't necessarily overdose because again, the tolerance goes up and they're not as at much risk. The problem is when they start mixing the opiates with other medications, and very few of my patients that are taking that many opiates are not taking an additional addictive substance like Xanax or Valium or alcohol. Don't forget alcohol. So these often synergistically play together to decrease the respiratory drive, and it happens very suddenly. And patients may or may not expect it, and it's a dangerous thing to mix these medications, but a lot of people do it.
What do we know about why some people can be prescribed these medications and perhaps even use them non-medically and not become addicted, whereas other people can even have a single course or two of these medications and really start to feel like they need them? Are there other things going on in their lives? Is there something genetic that they might have in common with other addicts?
I do think that there's a genetic predisposition to addiction. When we look at addiction and we look at the family history, we almost always find a family lineage. Now, that's not to say that it can't happen to anybody, and there's a certain amount of mystery that goes with it. But I do know that in the patient demographics that I work with, I almost always find an underlying trauma or an underlying hurt that that when they begin to take the medications unintentionally and to their surprise, it also relieves those psychological symptoms. And so Of course, they're going to continue to seek that because perhaps they've been carrying the psychological pain with them most of their life, and suddenly they have accidentally discovered what they believe to be the cure for their ailment. And so they don't want to put it down, and they continue to seek it. And a lot of times these traumas or pain underlying issues can seem insurmountable and impossible to work on in any other way. And so this is maybe a quick fix, but truly not. These are usually people that have just been hurting for so long that they don't even realize it until they no longer hurt. And they attest that to the medications.
Yeah, I think the I completely agree. There's usually something going on that we can if we spend enough time with the patient or get enough information that we can sometimes pick up on. If you look at the data for genetic risk factors, which most of this data comes from twin studies, where they look at identical twins, and if you raise those identical twins in separate environments, does one twin, despite having parents that are not using in the other twin, do they both end up with addiction or not? And most of the studies for any sort of addiction show about a 50% concordance rate, meaning that about half the time it's genetic related. So, yeah, we got about 50% risk from genes, but then so obviously there's some sort of environmental component, and that's often the difficult part to parse out as to what may be contributing to the addiction. But a lot of times what I see with patients that are using some sort of prescription medication for non-medical use, there's often a serious major depressive disorder, which is depression with a capital D, not necessarily just being sad. Some sort of serious comorbid psychiatric issue. And these other psychiatric issues like severe major depressive disorder and generalized anxiety disorder and some of the other serious psychiatric disorders, they're much higher in the addicted population than they are in the general population. So we know that that probably predisposes patients. Even if you look at premorbidly before they develop their addiction, most of them had some sort of psychiatric history in the past, like Pepper said, with either with trauma or some sort of serious issue that happened in childhood, but also psychiatric disorders that evolved and developed in their early teens and early 20s that may predispose them to this addiction.
Before we open up the phones, I do want to touch on the problem of stimulant abuse, and particularly among young people. We're hearing now that high school and college students are seeking out the kinds of drugs that are prescribed for ADHD, whether or not they actually have a mental condition that would be helped by this. What's the pull of these, and how addictive are these drugs that I think young people might view as safe because they've grown up with 50 kids who have taken these under the care of a doctor?
Well, absolutely. One pull that I see in working with eating disorders is that stimulants, they distract us from our appetite, mm-hmm. and they also increase our energy. And so one big demographic is eating disorder patients who then will seek out stimulants to help them lose weight. And a secondary one that I see is college students. I see this quite a bit where suddenly they're faced with a much bigger load of homework and duties. Perhaps they're working a part-time job, and then they also want to go out and party with their friends, and they'll start abusing stimulants in order to have that awake period. Mm-hmm. I think that Lee can speak more to the medical side of it, but I have seen quite a bit of cardiac damage.
Sure, that you have that much
Yes.
Stimulant
exactly.
medication.
Yeah, exactly. And just becoming dependent on the medication to where you really can't function without taking your Focalin or your methamphetamines for the day. And I think it's a again, I take it back to the culture. I think there's a cultural idea we live in a day and age where standardized test scores are really highly valued We live on the go and on the quick, and anything that helps us function better and function more efficiently in a shorter amount of time is prized.
Excuse me for interrupting. Did you see this among your colleagues in medical school?
No comment. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing how many people take Adderall who mm-hmm. aren't actually prescribed it, and other stimulants. I shouldn't just pick on Adderall. It's become part of the culture in campuses now. I think it's actually non-medical use of prescription medications has surpassed marijuana as far as teenagers that are abusing it have first used it. So the thing that they first use in college or in high school is now a prescription medication over marijuana. So that's kind of telling, right? And there's this idea that I can't get into the college of my dreams unless I do a certain score on this test. And so I think that there's that idea. There's a cultural idea, and I think that that increases the amount of expectation that people have that they can they need stimulants in order to function at a certain level. And there's also the overdiagnosis and misdiagnosis of ADHD so commonly. And so I see so many patients that come to me believing that they have it, whether they do or not, whether they have ADHD and can't survive without stimulants. And so I think that that's kind of how it starts, you know. I think that the problem with stimulants is they would help all of us in the population if we took it. You know, they would probably make us all focus a little bit better. They help a certain population, obviously, way more than they do the general population. So I think that that's part of the problem with stimulants is everybody likes them if they take them. And that can become a problem for those people, like we talked about before, that might be predisposed to developing a dependence and addiction on these things.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Buddy in Dallas. Hi, Buddy.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Great conversation, by the way. My question is this. I mean, I'm not the opiates, and one thing is that's not what I'm looking at, but I have some conditions where I end up having to take 9 pills, and over a course of a day it's like 12 of the 9 pills every day. And without getting into my medical history, it kind of scares me that 2 of the pills I have to take, they basically keep seizures at bay. And it's over a period of time, it seems like my seizures still kind of are there, so they increase the seizure medication. And it's one of those things I'm going to have to be on for the rest of my life, it appears. And it kind of scares me that I have to take, you know, those type of pills, you know, I'm 42 right at the moment. And, you know, up until my 60s, 70s, 80s, I'm going to have to be taking these pills.
Well, Buddy, it takes us a little bit off course, but I can certainly understand your concern. I'm guessing this is the kind of thing that you need to go back to your physician with and say, I'm worried about long-term effects.
Yeah, it sounds like this might be benzodiazepines if I had to guess, because they often can help seizures. They do help seizures because they lower they raise the seizure threshold, so you're less likely to have a seizure. The problem is if you quickly stop benzodiazepines like Xanax, Valium, Klonopin, some of the ones that you probably heard of, if you stop them abruptly, you are much more likely to have a seizure from withdrawal from those medications, just like you can with alcohol if you become an alcoholic and then abruptly stop alcohol. So these medications, yes, they do quell your seizures in the short term, but they also put you at risk for having seizure, becoming dependent on these medications. If you don't have them, you could potentially have a seizure in the future from getting off these medications too quickly. So it certainly you need to work very closely with your neurologist or your primary care doctor in trying to figure out ways that you might be able to manage your seizure disorder without being on benzodiazepines if possible. Sometimes it's not possible. It just depends on the degree of severity. But that would be something I would encourage you to speak with your physicians about, because there are ways to manage seizures without being on benzodiazepines.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to David in Wiley. Hi, David.
Hello. I'd like to give, I guess, a patient's perspective. I'm a cancer patient, and I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. But in the run-up to that, I saw various specialists who would all start me out at the baseline of pain medication. And so, you know, I would be... My pain level was increasing. I'd say doubled every 3 weeks, and it took me 6 months to get diagnosed, and I was essentially at the end where I could not even go to sleep. I felt that there were two problems. I guess one is that the pain scale for me is completely different from probably other people. I would be saying I'm at a pain level 3, and I consider pain level 10 being my arm is cut off and I'm bleeding out on the ground, whereas, you know, other people might have said higher. And but then each doctor would also, again, start me out at a base level every time. I guess they're worried that I was looking for, there's no obvious external problem with me. I mean, the pancreatic tumor was impinging on some nerves internally, so there's no evidence.
David, I think we lost your hookup there. I'm sorry about the diagnosis, and I certainly wish you the best of health. But David's points really speak to the fact that it's hard to communicate about pain because we all have a different understanding of what it means, and we all, I suppose, have a different tolerance, you know, the amount that we can live with and the amount that we think is, you know, at the very top of the scale.
Absolutely. As Lee said earlier, pain is completely subjective. And it's impossible for us to truly know what somebody is experiencing when they try to communicate their pain level to us. We have to look at a lot of different factors when we consider that. And that's why I think in the treatment of chemical addiction, especially prescription medications, it's really important that there be a team, a counselor and a psychiatrist, a medical team as well. This is something that truly takes a village. If I was only to talk to the patient, I would only be looking at the emotional pain, and I wouldn't truly be treating them holistically. And so we have to work as a team, as a community, to treat people with pain disorders who also may have an addiction to those medications.
Amen. I mean, that's exactly the point I would love to make, because so much of this, we act as though we can treat this in a vacuum and that this is my patient and I'm the only physician or the only therapist or person dealing with the pain, but it really has. I mean, I think that speaks to what we need as far as communication as doctors. That, you know, to have to restart when it's very frustrating for a patient to have to restart when they get to a new clinician or physician and need you know and need, have the same needs that they had with the previous physician, to have to retell, start from ground zero and build up. So I know that that's frustrating, and we need to do a better job as medical practitioners of communicating. I'm glad that he brought up cancer pain, because I think that that's a different beast altogether. Cancer pain is something that is very, very difficult to treat and refractory to pain medications. And so most of what we're talking about in this show is probably not cancer related, because that's that is something that has to be more aggressively treated with pain medications.
We're speaking this hour about addiction to prescription drugs with Dr. Lee Spencer of Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital and Pepper Harper of Sante Center for Healing. We'll resume the conversation in 2 minutes. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with case manager Pepper Harper of Sante Center for Healing and Dr. Lee Spencer, an addiction psychiatrist on the medical staff at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital, who is also director of chemical dependency at Texas Health Dallas. We're talking about addiction to prescription drugs. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I would imagine by the time patients come to see either of you or your colleagues, they have tried and failed to stop this on their own. Why is it so hard? And I don't mean that question to be flip. What makes it so challenging to kick the habit?
You know, that's one of the questions that I get the most from family members when somebody is coming into treatment is, I don't understand why they can't just quit. And they'll usually back that with, they're highly intelligent, they made straight A's, they graduated first in their class. And, you know, we really have to separate this from any amount of intelligence. And the way that I explain it is once the substance is introduced into the body over a certain amount of time, it becomes a basic need. So if you think about thirst, you think about hunger, you think about breathing, those are things that we obviously cannot live without. Let's say that we don't eat for a day, I'm pretty hungry. I don't eat for 2 days, I start to think about eating things I don't normally like. I am ravished, and that's all I can think about is food. It's a basic need, and all of my energy goes to finding food. Addiction is the same way. once it's introduced and it's been built up in the system, it is a basic need. And I don't have to think about whether or not it's time to get hungry. I just get hungry. And I don't think about whether or not I'm craving this drug. It just happens. And the longer I go without it, the more I must have it. And eventually I'll get sick, physically sick. And then I must have the drug just so I can feel well. And you'll hear addicts say that. They'll say, I'm going to get sick if I don't take it. And they mean that. And as Lee mentioned earlier, eventually the euphoric high no longer occurs and they simply need it to feel normal. It's a basic need.
Yeah, I love that explanation because it acts just like these other basic biological drives that we have, like you said, like hunger and thirst and sleep. And in fact, it actually takes place in the same areas of the brain that these particular basic needs and basic biological drives take place. What we call down in the midbrain, sort of your primitive brain. And that area sort of connects with your limbic system, which is an area of your brain that kind of regulates emotion. So using these substances take on this sort of emotional significance and deep-seated significance and primitive urging and craving like you were talking about that doesn't really respond to sort of rational thought in the higher areas of your brain that we call the cortex and are, you know, associated with executive control and just saying no and inhibitions and things like that. So it's operating on this more primitive level, almost like a survival sort of functionality. And when somebody is so driven by abusing a non-prescription medication or alcohol or something like that that takes on this sort of overdriven behavior, it's as though they need it to survive. It takes on this survival idea that it's almost sort of fight or flight. And when they get in a stressful situation or they get upset about something, somebody says the wrong thing, somebody says the right thing, they get excited about something. It's a quick short circuit to this sort of deep-seated primitive brain. And so a lot of people don't really understand that because most of us don't experience that with drugs. But patients who become addicted, whether they're predisposed to it or not, they develop this sort of idea that they have to have it. And that thing is very hard to control. And it takes on what researchers have called salience, which is how much does a thing increase the pleasure area of the brain? So the pleasure area of the brain works on something called dopamine. So how much does a thing increase my dopamine and make me want it to do whatever it takes to get it? And these drugs for patients that develop addictions they take on increasing salience over time, and the salience surpasses the normal things of daily life. So going to the movies is no longer fun as doing heroin. Why would it be? Why would I want to spend time with my family if I could spend time with my family while I'm taking Xanax or hydrocodone? So the salience drops for other daily activities and it rises for drugs, and that's very hard to counteract. It's very hard to say no to.
So what tools do you give people to essentially overcome what has become a biochemical, biological need?
Well, it really depends a lot on what is driving the addiction and what has brought them into treatment. So, for example, if a car accident while they were intoxicated or a difficult family event was the catalyst that brought them into treatment, I'm going to use that to help keep them sober while I work on the underlying addiction. And as Lee attested to earlier, we usually find a mental health disorder under there or some trauma, as I mentioned. And really, they're going to continue to seek healing or temporary healing from the psychological pain with drugs or alcohol until we can truly relieve the underlying issue. Secondary to that is the trauma of the addiction itself. A lot of times the addiction drives people to places in their life that create shame. And as I mentioned earlier, family members often ask me, why can't they just stop? Well, I'm not the first person they've asked that to. Typically, they've said that to the patient daily for some time. And the patient doesn't have a good answer. They typically don't have a good explanation of what is happening to them. They just can't stop. And so when they can't, they develop shame. So now we have the underlying issue, the effects of the addiction itself, and the shame that comes from the addiction. Typically, by this point, we're going to have employment issues, and we're going to have family issues, financial issues. So by the time they come in, their life is in disarray. We want to relieve that pain, but we want to do so in a way that doesn't require them to use another medication. That just simply takes time. It's not a quick fix. And that's the second thing I tell family members. They won't be better tomorrow. but they will get better.
Yeah, and I think you're also doing the one of the most important things at Sante or what we're doing at Presbyterian or wherever is that we're stopping the addiction. So we're stopping mm-hmm. the access. So when they're in treatment, they don't have access to the hydrocodone or to the Xanax or whatever. And so that biologic drive starts to decrease over that period while they're there. And while they're in that midst, while they don't have access to the substance, so we're stopping the behavior, we work on some of these antecedents to the use and the things that take on significance for their for whatever is promoting and maintaining their drug use. So the antecedents may be like seeing a needle, being around certain people that they're used to using with, getting on the internet.
Triggers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cruising sites where they previously were spending hours trying to acquire these medications, going to certain areas of town where certain doctors that they might be used to shopping with or certain dealers might be. So identifying what is maintaining this disorder and keeping them in this sort of overdriven behavior. How can we parse this out and figure out what some of these fundamental elements might be that we can isolate and start to work on, through some of these cognitive and behavioral tricks? And sometimes we do, for some of this, we do have medications that can help with these, like we were talking about earlier, for some of these dopamine increases and drives that give this these substances increased salience. We have medications that can help decrease some of the drive. They're not perfect. They don't take it away completely. But they do give patients enough relief maybe from cravings and urges to use that can buy us some time and doing some therapy and things like that with them to work on changing their lifestyle.
People may or may not have a lot of hang-ups about using street drugs, crystal meth or cocaine or heroin or whatever. But it is, in itself an illicit act. I wonder if the fact that these drugs sometimes start out being prescribed by a physician causes patients who develop a dependency to be in denial more profoundly or for a longer period of time than if they became hooked on another drug that they had to buy on the street.
Well, absolutely it does. And there's a lot of justification that goes around that when they first come in and seek help. And obviously they've come in to seek help. So there's some aspect of their authentic self that knows that this is not okay. But it is easy to justify it and to say, well, I was prescribed by a physician this medication. I was just getting a little bit more from my friend. Or the addiction is allowed to go on longer because they can actually say to their family members, like, I was prescribed this by my doctor. And so sometimes that will hold off family members or friends for a little bit of time, and it lets the addiction grow. Typically, once we put the patient addicted to pain medications in a group format with other types of addicts and they all start to talk to each other, it becomes pretty obvious pretty fast that they're all suffering from the same disease. And
do they see it? Excuse me for interrupting. Mm-hmm. Do they see it in the other people in the room and not so much in themselves at first?
In the beginning, yes. Mm-hmm. But typically, they're able to relate to that peer. Like, well, yes, I use heroin and my wife has left me and my employer has fired me and I have no money in my bank account. And then as a counselor, you can say, what are your effects of your prescription drug abuse? Well, my wife has left me and I've lost my job and I have no money in my bank account. And sometimes just open forums like that will take care of a lot of the denial.
Yeah, denial is a fundamental part of addiction.
Yes.
Yeah, so regardless of what the substance is, there's going to be denial involved. But as you pointed out, there is a particular problem with the rationale and the justification for these because they do start off as, sort of innocently prescribed maybe for a certain ailment, for a certain anxiety, for a certain pain. The one that I am thinking of is that I've noticed has become an increasing problem is Ambien, which is a sleep medication. We haven't talked much about hypnotics, but it's a sleep medication. And I was talking to a patient about this recently. The idea she'd gotten up to very high doses of this and had started having real cognitive problems from it. But the idea was that I can't sleep, therefore I need this medication. This medication will help me sleep and will help me function. And in the future, as I'm functioning better, I won't have to take this medication as much. But as the dependence grows and the drive for this grows, the problem grows, and that justification keeps occurring. And the idea that somehow I'm responsible for keeping taking this medication somehow just gets lost in that rational part of the brain, and it goes to more of, like we talked about before, more of this deep part of the brain, and the denial keeps that going. So it's an interesting phenomenon.
So for people who, say, had a tooth extracted or had a knee injury and were prescribed medication and didn't finish it because they didn't need it for pain or whatever, or they have something in their house, what do we do with this stuff if we don't want it around, we don't want it available to somebody who might have a problem, but you don't want to, you know, it's not good to just dump it down the sink. What do you do with it?
Good question. I get patients asking me that question all the time, and I'm glad to take it from them. We will dispose, you can take it to your doctor and have them dispose of it. Sometimes pharmacies will take it. I'm hearing more and more that some pharmacies will not take it back, but some will. And if they will not, ask them what may be a good place to dispose of it, and they'll kind of point you in the right direction. But starting with your medical practitioner might be a good place to start as well. Some people really want to keep them and donate them to other clinics or to people that are suffering, and I just think it's a bad idea, especially if you have any propensity for addiction or this has been a problem. Get rid of the access to the medications so that you're not tempted, so it's not an issue. Just get rid of it. So taking it to your doctor's office or to your pharmacist would be, I think, a good place to start.
Do people who have health insurance typically have coverage to help them cope with addiction?
Not as much as we would like to say that there is, but there is some help. It's usually short term, and we find that it's not adequate enough to really enter recovery from addiction. And so, unfortunately, there is a population that falls in that gap where they are dependent upon insurance and simply don't have enough to get all of the care that they need.
Yeah, parity has helped a little bit with that, but it's still a big problem. And you know, underneath it, I think, is this idea that this is a moral behavior and a choice that people are making and not necessarily something that falls into the illness realm or disease realm. And I think that colors how payers pay for treatment, because if so-and-so is not giving up the substance, then I don't know what else to do to help them. So oftentimes relapse, going back to using the substance that you're trying to get into recovery from, is part of the process. It's quite common relapse. It's part of recovery, in fact. And so to have to pay for this ongoing treatment, a lot of times it's very intense treatment. They have to go to, you know, 30-day, 60-day program, or they have to go to treatment very regularly. I see a lot of my patients once a week, and that's, you know, it's not cheap. I can see where the payers get frustrated. It's a frustrating problem. It's frustrating for the doctors. It's frustrating for therapists. It's frustrating for patients. But we have to do a better job at funding the treatment on the front end so that we avoid having to fund it on the back end.
Absolutely agree. A lot of times insurance only pays for perhaps 10 to 15 days. We're really just getting them out of the detox process, if that. We haven't been able to reach the rational brain, and we haven't been able to have any really in-depth conversations on my end to really work on the addiction before they're cut free. And so then we do see the relapse, and we see them coming in and out of treatment multiple times.
And like you said before, this is a team approach and an intensive approach, and we have to get at psychological factors and family members, and it takes time and it takes resources and it takes money. I wish there was just a pill that we could give. It'd be a lot easier.
Dr. Lee Spencer is an addiction psychiatrist on the medical staff at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital. Pepper Harper is a case manager at Sante Center for Healing. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. If you'd like to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.